we're going to start off one of the most unlikely arenas of all to face just this situation, politics. Fair warning, if any of you are writers or you just love the written word, this one's going to hurt. Snap judgments. Joe Rosenberg has a story.
To say that Barton Swaim loves a writing would be an understatement. Barton is the kind of guy who still remembers the day back in grade school when he was taught how to diagram sentences.
And the whole class was moaning about it. Everybody was dying. It was so awful. And I thought it was the easiest and the best thing I'd ever done. It was so much fun. There was just something about putting words together that gave me some kind of sense of power that I didn't have. And since then, I knew I wanted to do that and nothing else.
Okay, so flash forward a few years. Barton is a struggling writer working in a library in a small southern state, which, for reasons soon to be obvious, shall remain nameless.
And I opened the state newspaper, and there was an op-ed by the governor. And it said, "Bolton, our third son, has always liked the story of the three bears. Work has begun on the state budget. And because that means hot, cold, or just right, now deals with your money, it's worth sizing up whether or not you think things are indeed right in this year's budget." I thought I had never read a worse opening. Hot, cold, or just right, now deals with your money. How does it deal with my money? It's so confusing. I'm even confusing myself thinking about it.
So Barton decided to write the governor a quick little letter.
And I forget the exact wording, but it was something like, "You need a writer. Please hire me." And it worked.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't that easy. There was a job interview, a few writing tests, but the bottom line is that Barton Swaim, the once little boy who had always wanted his words to have power, was suddenly the newest speechwriter for the most powerful politician in the state.
So when I first came into the office, you know, I was sort of overawed. I'd never talked to a governor before. He was famous and charming and good-looking, but we all sat down and there was silence for a long time. And eventually, he started to say something like, "Ooh, ooh." And I thought there was something wrong because he looked up at the ceiling and kept saying, "Ooh." And then finally, he looked at me and he looked at the chief of staff and said, "Ooh, what are we doing here?" And that should have been a warning sign. But, you know, after that, he was fine and we hit it off. You know, I felt like at last I'm doing the thing that I was meant to do. And then one day, he told me to write an op-ed on the state budget. And I think I wrote for hours, making every sentence just right. But he looked at the document we had given him, and he stormed into the office. And the first thing he said was, again. When he was really frustrated with you, he would begin what he had to say with the word again, as if he had said this to you before. But again. I would never say this. And he said that he would write it himself.
Then the governor handed Barton back the final draft of the op-ed.
And I just saw this really bad writing. And I was sort of inwardly devastated. And I looked at Nat, the other speechwriter, and said, "Wait, are you kidding? This is the way we're going to write?" And Nat seemed not at all fazed by this. And he said, "Welcome to hell." And so this is the way every one of my products would go. I would labor on it endlessly. He would hate it. He would rewrite it badly.
And it wasn't just that the governor was hard to write for. He was hard to work for, too. Like, really hard.
The first time I took a trip in the car with him, I'm sitting in the back. He's reading the newspaper in the front seat. And when he's done with a section of it, he throws it into the back seat. And, you know, I get slapped in the face with the Wall Street Journal. And I thought about this for a long time. You know, who would do that? I don't think he hated me. He didn't even know me. What I think was happening was when he's done with the paper, he doesn't even remember that you're in the back seat. And he's not throwing it at you. You're sort of invisible. You're a non-entity until he needed you. And then he would focus on you, usually in a bad way. And, you know, the event's going to start in 5 minutes, and he's agitated because he doesn't know what to say yet. So he says, "Okay, what am I saying here? I would say, all right, this is the such and such event. I think you should say, no, don't tell me I think you should say. I'm not going to stand up there and say, I think I should say. Just tell me what I'm going to say. Go. Okay. Maybe. No, don't say okay. Just tell me what I'm going to say. Start talking. Come on. I don't have time here. So I would have to immediately pretend to be him in front of him and another couple of staffers who are scared to say anything. And of course, you're going to sound like an idiot. So I would say, we've gathered today to celebrate the life and work of, you know, say, next. Okay, that one didn't work. So I would try Winston Churchill, spent the years leading up to the Second World War. Next. Nobody wants a history lesson. Okay, I really thought you would have liked that one. Next, come on. Go to number three. Recently, there was an Olympic downhill skier. Come on, nobody wants to hear about skiing and mishaps and stuff. Come on, next. James Madison, what's next? So I would go through my entire list in some cases and say, look, Governor, I'm out. And on the way to work in the morning, I would be ready to vomit. You just knew that some disaster awaited every day.
Barton says that every night he would come home and unload his woes onto his wife. How he knew he was a good writer, but how nothing he ever did seemed to please this one man who it was his job to please.
And she kept saying to me, you need to start writing badly. But I just couldn't bring myself to do it. For one thing, I had this sense that the governor knew bad writing when he saw it, unless he had written it. And I thought, if I write badly, he'll know it, and he'll fire me. On the other hand, you know, I began to sense that he was going to fire me anyway. So I decided to figure out how he writes badly and write in that way. And that's when I began to notice these patterns.
The patterns were words, phrases.
A level of, in this regard, speaks volumes.
Anything the governor liked to use.
Given the fact that none other than.
And reuse.
A level of.
That didn't seem to mean anything.
In which you operate.
At all.
One of his favorites, the word larger, you know, a larger notion. The phrase was so common that if you weren't sure he would approve a press release, somebody would say, just stick a larger notion in there somewhere and it should be fine.
And this is how Barton kept his job. Because the more he used these words and phrases, even though he knew that they were just pure rhetorical deadweight, the less the governor hated his work. For example, maybe he had to write a letter.
And it was a stupid little letter to some kid who had, I don't know, got an award for playing the tuba or something. And what I would want to say is, that's a remarkable honor for you, and I wish you the best of luck. But I would look at that line and think it's not long enough. And I would end up with something like, that's an incredible honor for you, and I do wish you the best of luck as you sharpen the remarkable talent you so obviously possess in spades.
Did you ever worry that, like, that your own writing skills would be, like, permanently marred from this?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it created a kind of rhythm in your head, but I can sort of see now that he had a point. Because on a paper from a politician written to a kid, it looks warmer. Because what you needed was feeling instead of strict truth. Which is probably somehow a metaphor for politics.
What Barton's getting at is that if you're a governor, or a mayor, or president, you're always expected to have something more to say, to fill the silence. So all that rhetorical deadweight, those empty phrases, they're actually really useful for a politician.
Because innumerable things go wrong in the world every day. And so the poor guy is expected to have some position on potentially anything in the world at any time. But you can't say, oh, we don't have any comment. It creates a bad vibe. So you're trying to avoid saying nothing. And so you say something, but really it's not, content-wise, it's nothing. So, you know, at the end of it, he did understand political language and the way it works. It was a process of trying to admit that maybe to myself.
Also, keep in mind that Barton still agreed with a lot of the governor's policies, thought he was doing a good job governing. So the guy's personality deficits, the fact that maybe, okay, he wasn't the best writer in the world, maybe that didn't matter so much.
It was weird. On one level, I really couldn't stand him. He's pretty much a jackass, and I didn't want to ever see him again. And on another level, he was accomplishing things. He was treating the job of governor seriously he was principled, to the point where he himself would suffer politically. So to me, and I think to other staffers, as much as we disliked him, there was something that we could not help admiring about him at the same time.
Now, up to this point, we've told you that Barton was simply working for the governor of a small southern state. Haven't said which one. But after what happens next, unless you were like in a coma or stuck in the Antarctic in 2009, you're going to know which governor we're talking about.
So one day, we're sitting in the office and a friend of mine told me that the governor had gone missing, and I didn't think much of it. Presumably he's somewhere and he's fine. He's a big boy. He can handle himself.
But then someone came in and said that the state law enforcement agency had put out an APB on the governor. In other words, he wasn't just missing anymore. He was more like a missing person.
And I immediately thought of this note that he had given me, and it was in his own handwriting. And he said, keep this for me and don't lose it. He told me it was important, and it said, "Once upon a time, there were three little pigs, and the time came for them to leave home and seek their fortunes. Before they left, their mother told them, 'Whatever you do, do it the best you can, because that's the way to get along in the world.'" So, okay, that's weird. And we did sit around and theorize about where he could have gone or what he was doing. But it was still a joke. I remember the phrase, we were using it a lot, slow news day. There's a phrase I'm not going to use again.
A political mystery in South Carolina. The Republican governor in that state has disappeared.
It's the case of the missing governor.
Missing for 6 days.
When he left his family, security detail, and cell phone behind and struck off on his own.
The lieutenant governor didn't even know he was going away.
I don't know whether they know where he is or whether they don't know where he is, so I don't know what to tell you on that because I don't know.
So who's in charge in South Carolina? Well, that's a good question.
Therefore, I, Stephen T. Colbert, hereby declare myself the new governor of South Carolina.
And then the press release went out at a weird time, like 10:30 at night. It said that he had been hiking on the Appalachian Trail. I think when I saw Appalachian Trail, I thought it's the sort of thing that he would do. And I'm pretty sure, no, I am virtually 100% certain that the communications director and the chief of staff believed that's where he was. But the fact that he was coming back tomorrow to hold a press conference didn't sound good either. The next day, there were hundreds of reporters everywhere. And usually I would be sort of running a press conference or, you know, pretending to run it. And I had nothing to do with this one. So I just stood there with the reporters wondering what in the world he was going to say. And the governor showed up, kind of made his way to the podium, cameras clicking, and he started off.
I won't begin at any particular spot. Let me just start with...
And it doesn't make any sense.
I don't see it. Where's Gina?
Watching the video of the press conference now, it's clear that the governor is doing something that's almost unheard of in modern politics. He's winging it.
I had a conversation with Gina.
And I've watched it since again, and it's just a wreck. And, he started rambling about
my love of the Appalachian Trail. I used to organize hiking trips. Actually,
trips he took
school,
as a Boy Scout, and
soccer coach,
he kept saying that he was going to tell it like it was.
I'm a bottom line kind of guy. I'll lay it out.
But it was just going around and around.
I guess where I'm trying to go with this is that there are moral absolutes.
And finally, he said the words,
I've been unfaithful to my wife.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. And I thought, oh, so we're doing one of those things. And I work for one of those politicians. So I just went back to my desk and sort of sat there numbly, and it was being broadcast live in our office on Fox News, and I could sort of hear what he was saying, and
at that point we went into serious overdrive,
it just
and
it never stops.
So it had been back and forth and back and forth.
The governor, although he really didn't need to, went out of his way to explain that he'd been having an affair. It turned out with a woman named Maria in Buenos Aires. that that's where he'd been all this time, without telling anyone. That he had real feelings for her, and that he was on some kind of heart odyssey.
And so, oddly enough, I spent the last 5 days of my life crying in Argentina.
And the comms director had to physically go up and pull him by the shoulder away from the podium to get him to stop.
Will you resign as governor?
And from that point forward, it was kind of like the governor had some kind of weird political logorrhea. He just didn't know when and didn't seem physically capable of shutting up. And all that political non-speak he loved to use, it was gone.
This was a whole lot more than a simple affair.
This is from an interview he gave to the AP just 2 days after the press conference.
And that's when he came out with this crazy stuff about his mistress was his soulmate and it was a love story.
A forbidden one, a tragic one, but a love story at the end of the day.
And so, you know, of course, that made our job infinitely harder. And I already didn't like him, but at least I felt he was principled. And now he wasn't even principled. He's just a big liar.
Barton's job now mostly consisted of scrubbing letters and press releases of potentially incriminating words. The governor's office could no longer use terms like integrity, loyalty, values. Other phrases were now just too funny to use. Phrases like foreign affairs or hiking interest rates.
He had a letter that would go out to couples who had been recently engaged. Just don't say anything weird, he said. So I had to write a full paragraph about the importance of marriage without in any way mentioning actual marriage. And at one point, I drafted a release, and it said something about an honest look at the numbers. And he came in to the office, and he said it looked pretty good, but he pointed to that line and said, maybe take out the thing about an honest look, because I'm not really somebody who should be lecturing people on honesty. And he said it with kind of a sad look, and at that moment, I felt maybe I could forgive him.
Scandals are funny things. The scandalousness of a scandal tends to decay. It always seems important at the start. People feel hurt, but then time passes. People stop talking about it. And in politics, if something isn't being talked about, it doesn't exist. So Barton, after a while, he started to have hope that all this would pass.
It was a while after the scandal, and you know, you could almost start to see light. And we were doing a press conference on some piece of legislation, and there were four or five lawmakers were behind the podium with him. It was very, you know, gubernatorial. You know, he seemed to be back to the business of being governor. And in that instance, there were a couple of questions from the press were actually about the issue. And then this AP reporter raised his hand and said, "Are you still seeing her, your mistress, Maria?" And I watched it all. You could see the look on his face, and his instinct was to sidestep the question. But there was something about hearing her name, Maria, that he just couldn't help himself. And he started to answer it, and he said, something like, well, it's not going to be easy to maintain a relationship across that distance, but we're going to try to work through that. And, you know, all the news of the thing was gone, and the reporters are furiously scribbling down their answer. And the lawmakers who had joined us at this press conference started sort of sneaking away. They wanted nothing to do with this. But the AP guy, he wanted the details. So he really started pressing the governor and saying, so just to be clear, you are still seeing her. And you could see the governor trying not to answer but wanting to answer. And he said, the obvious is the obvious. And at that point, you realize, okay, so he's actually going to talk about his mistress. After the press conference that night, I was still in the office by myself, and the governor came in, and I hardly ever had any time with him, you know, just one-on-one. But in that instance, he just sat down, and he seemed to want to talk. So he finally said, how do you think that went? And, you know, a lot of things went through my mind. And I finally said, well, when the AP reporter asked you whether you were still seeing her, you should have just said, you know what, I'm not here to talk about my personal life. Sometimes you should just say what every other politician would say. I said, do you realize Michael Jackson died the day after it all happened? And the whole thing would have been buried. But you just had to be different and say something weird.
Were you surprised at yourself with your own frankness with him in this moment?
Yeah, because it was one of the last things I ever said to him. And I'd never done that before with him. But what I said was true. And he thought about it. And after a while, he said, I'm always looking for language that's... And he couldn't think of the term. Language that's somehow larger. I remember that the word larger was one of his favorite expressions. But larger than what? I didn't know. I did feel that he never could quite put into words his own vision and outlook. And I think that's always the struggle for people who have big ideas, but they never can quite be satisfied with the language they're able to describe it with. And that was his frustration, because I couldn't find that language that was somehow larger. It was just, at the end of the day, it was just language.
Big thanks to Barton Swaim. His memoir of time in the rhetorical trenches is called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. Find it wherever books are sold. And just a note before we continue. We edited the tape of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's press conference to fit our story. But you can find links to the entire excruciating 18-minute version and to Barton's memoir on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design for that piece was by Renzo Gorio. It was produced by Joe Rosenberg.